Hola. Buenos días, hermanos y hermanas. I won't identify him. I asked if this is correct. Was that brought to us by the Cinco Gringos? It was very nice, gentlemen. I think a lot of us have taken it of Spanish in high school, maybe college, that we understood quite a few of those words. That was very lovely. Thank you. I guess this is the survival group from the flu epidemic. How many of you either were or had a family member or friend affected by the flu? Very few from this side, but almost everybody from this side. Yeah. Well, good. Apparently, it was quite widespread in Southern California. I want to get right into the message. Those of you that were at the Festival of Tabernacles in Escondido, this message is somewhat similar. So you see hear some strains, both in my voice and strains in the message that you'll remember from the feast. But I've altered it greatly in many, many ways. One subject that we covered as a study, if you want more information on it, is relative to the Feast of Tabernacles and the 7 days, and why we now note the eighth day as the eighth day. I'll give you a little bit of a hint. And it has to do with the sacrifices of Numbers and Deuteronomy. It was a fascinating study. We got a lot of interest from it at the feast. But to begin, in life, we expect good outcomes. They're, in many ways, expected. It's what we desire. When you light a fire out in the woods, in your fireplace, there's a reasonable expectation of warmth and possibly the need or the wherewithal to cook food. When you flip on a light switch at home, you expect a light or a device to work as soon as you do so. In my life, when I was much, much younger, I studied chemistry, and I became, quote, an analytical bench chemist. When I tell some of the people that take chemistry now, they asked me, Mr. Garnett, did you use wooden pipes? Had glass been invented yet? And I said, yes, I used lots and lots of glass. Chemistry is a world of reasonable expectations. We perform certain experiments or processes or procedures carefully with a reasonable expectation of a particular result. Because I was a bench chemist, I was the lowest of the low. It was tedious, it was monotonous, it was a lot of very repetitive work, and yes, there was lots of glass. Very few electronics. Today, we have a few in the room. We have chemists that basically take a little syringe, a pipette, inject it into this great big piece of machinery, walk away for 3 or 4 hours on a coffee break, and come back, and they get results. That's chemistry today. But when we test for a certain, I'll probably get talked to after church, I'm sure. When you test for a certain compound, a chemical compound, you have a reasonable expectation during a controlled and expected reaction would occur. If it didn't occur, something went horribly wrong, and we would usually have a lot of cleanup. When I graduated to research, it was a lot more fun. We had a lot more latitude. You prepared to run a test. You varied the ingredients. You wanted to modify the expected result, but it was still a reasonable expectation of what the result would be. If not, you went back, examined the reagents, the procedures, the conditions, recleaned the glassware, and did it again, and over again in many cases. And the reason is, in your everyday life, we want the ivory soap that you have in your bathroom to be the same on your bath everywhere in the world, 20 million times, every time the same. So this is the expected reasonable reaction. Chemistry is founded, in fact, on God's laws. Chemistry doesn't care, it doesn't realize this, but nonetheless it's there. It follows these laws. In finance, reasonable expectation is where an investor has a realistic and somewhat detailed expected return on their investment. It's not as exact as chemistry, it's far from it. But we know when we go to the bank, we expect some type of return, low though it may be, a return nonetheless. Finance is not based on God's law, but the expectation is still there. It is a reasonable, rational expectation. Else, why would you do it? You do it because of what you would receive. Today, what I'd like to talk to you is about and examine a different perspective of Christ's Beatitudes. In fact, special music relates to the book of Matthew. We will be in the book of Luke. We will talk about what is a reasonable expectation of our actions. What is it that God desires in those actions, and why God expects us to act with, in fact, quote, an unreasonable expectation. And that's the title of the message. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Luke, where we'll spend the vast majority of our time. This is his version of the Beatitudes. He has a very interesting section in it that Matthew really doesn't have. And I'd like to begin there in verse 24. He says, "But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation." And you'll see successively four woes. Four woes for four different reasons. Woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation, your reward. Woe to you who are full, for you shall hunger. Woe to you who shall laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for so did the fathers to the false prophets. It says, woe to the rich, those full of stomach, those that are laughing now, and those that are very easily flattered, hypocritically flattered. For they've received their reward, yet they will hunger, they will weep, and they are in fact deceived. They had their friends who flattered them, said nice things about them, didn't mean it. And they had prosperity, they prospered well. They were full and they were happy. Their lives, though, were based on lies. Reminds me of a story I recently came across. And it's a story of two brothers. They both were very rich. They also were very wicked. Both lived a wild, unprofitable existence using their wealth to cover up the dark side of their lives. On the surface, however, few would have guessed it, for these consummate cover-up artists attended the same church almost every week and contributed large sums of money to various church-related projects. Then the church called a new pastor, a young man who preached the truth with zeal and with courage. Before long, attendance had grown so much that the church needed a larger worship center. Being a man of keen insight and strong integrity, this young pastor had also seen through the hypocritical lifestyles of these two brothers. Suddenly, one of the brothers died, and the young pastor was asked to preach his funeral. The day before the funeral, the surviving brother pulled the minister aside and handed him an envelope. "There's a check in here that is large enough to pay the entire amount you need for the new sanctuary," he whispered. "All I ask is one favor. Tell the people at the funeral that he was a saint." The minister gave the brother his word. He would do precisely what was asked, and that afternoon he deposited the check into the church's account. The next day, the young pastor stood before the casket at the funeral service and said with firm conviction, "This man was an ungodly sinner, wicked to the core. He was horrible to his wife, hot-tempered to his children, ruthless in his business, and a hypocrite at church. But compared to his brother, he was a saint." So when men speak well of you, woe to you, Jesus said. Woe to you. It says that so did their fathers to the false prophets. Jesus tells us through history, this is what occurred in the past, that people are like the false prophets. They live false lives. And now he gives us some advice. And though it was said in the 30s AD, where we need to transport ourselves back there and then forward again to truly understand it, it is very much applicable today. One of the things that we have heard in this country especially and in Europe as well is the idea about rights. Everybody has rights and they demand those rights. My right to dignity, basically to do whatever I want to do. My right of expression, that you have to listen to me in what I have to say. My right to fair treatment, no matter what I've done, even though I've admitted I've done it. And my rights of possession, that I can keep everything that I wish to keep. And if you abridge those rights, you'll be in court. Rights we demand. We want complete fairness, don't we? Absolute equality. We want perfect justice. This is what we want. It's what the world says it wants. They want all of this. If I treat you fairly, at least in my mind, you are required to treat me fairly too. You must. The world demands equality in all things. Everyone wants equality. Everything fair. Often, in some ways, it creeps into the church. We want everybody to act fairly. We want everyone to be honest. We want them to be equal in their interactions with us. We want complete and utter justice, don't we? Don't we? We want everyone to treat us fairly. We want it to be honest. Reminds me of another story of a lady in an airport. She was between flights at an airport and she bought a small package of cookies. Then she sat down in a busy snack shop to glance over the newspaper. And as she read her paper, she became aware of a rustling noise. Peeking above the newsprint, she was shocked to see a well-dressed gentleman sitting across from her, helping himself to her cookies. She was beside herself. Half angry, half embarrassed, she did not know what to do. So she reached over and gently slid the package closer to her as she took one out and began to munch on it. She was furious. A minute or so passed before she heard more rustling. The man had gotten another cookie. By now, there was only one left in the package. Though flabbergasted, she didn't want to make a scene, so she said nothing, as mad as she was. Finally, as if to add insult to injury, the man picked up the remaining cookie and broke it into two pieces, pushed one piece across the table toward her with a frown, gulped down his half, and left without even saying thank you. She sat there absolutely dumbfounded. Sometime later, when her flight was announced, the woman opened her handbag to get her ticket. To her shock, there in her purse was her package of unopened cookies. And somewhere in that same airport was another traveler still trying to figure out how that strange woman could have been so forward and insensitive. Assumptions are easy to shake when you want everyone else to be fair. What if I told you that God wants us to do things that make absolutely no sense? They make no sense. What he asks us to do makes no sense. The reasonable and the rational expectation is from God, in fact. The reasonable and expected reaction is, in fact, from God, unreasonable. Go on, if you would, with me with verse 27. Jesus continues again, and this is found also in Matthew. Now, when we read the Beatitudes in Matthew, in fact, turn over there with me, one finger in Luke chapter 6, move over to Matthew chapter 538, and you'll see periodically through the book of Matthew, in fact, we'll start just, we're going to use one line, chapter 5, verse 21, it says, "You have heard that it was said." It says again in verse 27, we're in Matthew 5, "You have heard that it was said." Verse 31, "Further it has been said." He's quoting Exodus and Deuteronomy in Matthew. Verse 33 of Matthew 5, "Again you have heard that it was said to those of old." In verse 38, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye." Verse 43, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." These are all in the main quotations from Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, from the law. Let's go back now to Luke chapter 6, verse 27. Luke does not have these references to the law. So either this is a truncated version or a completely different discourse. But the effect is the same. The words are almost identical. So if you want a different expansion, you read Matthew, but Luke, I think, has got a very interesting perspective. He says, I say to you, after hearing all this about woe, woe to the rich, woe who are full, woe who laugh, and woe to you when men speak well of you, he says, what I say to you, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you and pray for those who spitefully use you. He says, to him who strikes you on one cheek, offer the other also. And from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. These don't make sense. This is not a reasonable expectation. This is illogical. Why would we love people who are our enemies? Why would we do good to those who hate us? Why would we pray for those who spitefully use us and bless those who curse us? That's not fair. That's not equitable. That's not equal. You're giving up your rights. You're giving up those things that the world wants. The world wants rights, and Jesus says something very, very much the opposite. He says, what's interesting, those that hate you, curse you, and use you. How many of you, no raise of hands, please, how many of you have ever been hated or cursed or used? You've been abused, you've been misused, and therefore you're confused. We've all experienced that. Or something went wrong, and now we're hated, or horribly disliked, or cursed, or said bad things about, or had bad things done to. Often in religious circles, it can get even uglier, can't it? Right? There's nothing like a good religious fight, right? At least that's what the seculars say. There's nothing like a good religious fight. Those religious people, they know how to fight. It seems sometimes it's a lot deeper. And so sometimes we need to stop, and we need to think, and we need to be just exactly like that little child that was up here. Somewhat innocent, somewhat naive, very loving, unconcerned about those things around them. So we adopt the attitude of a little child. So what should be our response when people do it all the time? They do it, unfortunately, sometimes in the church, but they do it out in the world, we know, all the time. It's sport. It's great fun. There are people who thrive on it. They excel at it, of using and abusing people, and you become hated and basically cursed. Our response, Jesus says, is to love them, to bless them, and to pray for them. Just exactly what would be an unreasonable expectation. The reasonable expectation for someone who hates you is to do what? What would be fair? Hate them back. If they curse you, what would be fair and equitable? Curse them back. If they despitefully use you, what's the reasonable expectation? Do the same. In fact, do unto others before they do unto you, isn't it? That is the normal reaction. When someone cuts us off in the freeway, about the last thing we want to do, well, the first thing we think about, and I don't think this way, but I've heard other people say this, that when someone cuts you off on the 210, right, what's the first reaction? Speed up and cut them off, or at least hope an 18-wheeler gets there before you do, and he cuts them off for you. Now, I know that's not true among you. I checked with Becky, and I asked her if this was indeed applicable to the freeways of Southern California. I had some doubt, and she said, yes, it is applicable, these verses are, to the Southern California freeways. It's also applicable to work. It's also applicable to the supermarket. It's also applicable to every facet of our lives. So when we have enemies, we are to love them. When they hate us, we are to do good to them. When they curse us, we're to bless them. And we're to pray for those who use you, or when they use you, we're to pray for them. That is not a natural or reasonable expectation. He says in general to do these things, and then in verse 29, he gets specific. To him who strikes you on one cheek, offer the other also. Now, in those days, cheek in Jesus' day was a euphemism for a very terrible insult. I'll give you a reference of, though we will not turn there, you may reference Lamentations 3:30. It's a euphemism. It does not mean necessarily that someone slaps someone else. In fact, what's interesting is that it's called a backhanded slap, because most people are right-handed, and to slap someone on their right cheek, you'd have to what? Backhand them. We use the phrase even today. That was a backhanded insult or a backhanded compliment. It was not easily or wantingly given. It's given basically as an insult. So he says, when they insult you, let them. When they insult you, continue to let them insult you to a point. Let's talk about what we're not talking about. Because the natural inclination is to retaliate. I can remember a situation in particular where one member was railing on another member for a horrible thing. Horrible. The member took it, and they took it, and they took it. He knew he really wasn't the one to blame, but he took it. And after 5 or 6 minutes, he decided to respond. He said, "I understand. I should have done more." Now, the reason I know this is the one that was insulting him talked about it. So I went to the other individual and I said, "Why did you respond that way? I'm just curious. I think it was noble." I said, "I'm not sure I would have responded the same way." He said, "I had two choices." He said, "I was substantially bigger than the other individual. I could have decked him with one punch." He said, "That would have been the improper and wrong reaction." He said, "As justified and satisfied as it would have felt," he said, "it would have been a wrong reaction." He said he knew it wasn't that man's fault that he felt that way. He was emotional. He was under a lot of stress. So when we have people who are railing against us, sometimes we need to let them within reason. The cloak is another interesting concept in Jesus' day. It says, verse 30, "Give to everyone who asks of you, and from him who takes away your goods..." "And from him who takes away your cloak," verse 29, "him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either." Now, many of us know that in Jesus' day, there was the cloak, which was the outer coat, overcoat, as it were, and underneath it was a tunic, not quite a shirt, but a kind of a longer, heavier shirt. Everyone had a cloak, and even today, if you look in certain parts of the Middle East, you'll see most of the men with long, heavy coats. It kept them cool in the heat and warm in the cold. If they traveled, in Jesus' day especially, they would use it as a blanket. They would wrap themselves in it and sleep on it. It was like a ground cover. It was very, very important to them. It was something of unbelievable need in those days. To lose your cloak was to lose your protection just for everyday physical living. So when Jesus says, if I can find it, he takes your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. It has to be looked upon as a euphemism and not literal. But Jesus tries to show the unbelievable importance of giving up, releasing, and not resisting. He's talking here as a principle is when you suffer, release it. And all of us have suffered loss at the hands of someone else. Luke continues, and he says in verse 31, he says, "And just as you want men to do to you, you also do to them likewise." We know that as the version of the golden rule. As you wish men to do to you, do also to them. Now let's speak to what we're not talking about. What we're not talking about is someone who is physically abusing. What we're not talking about is someone who is hurting you or your family. You have a duty and a right to protect. But we are talking about interpersonal relationships. Jesus talks in the Beatitudes all about our attitudes. He is not talking about any type of physical threat whatsoever. He's not talking at all about someone who is harassing you to the point where you feel physically threatened. You should get away from those people as fast as possible. But he still goes on to say, and the principle is, do to others as you would have them to do to you. Now that may seem like a reasonable expectation. I want people to treat me like I treat other people. But it's deeper than that. Because if people treated me like I treated other people, I don't think I'd be happy. I don't know about you, but sometimes I don't treat people the way I want to be treated. Therefore, I'm not treated that way. It's linked, as we know, this version of the Golden Rule to Leviticus 19:18, where it says, to love our neighbor as ourselves. It was one of the epitome of the law in Jewish literature. To love our neighbor as ourselves. But again, is this reasonable? Is this a reasonable expectation? No, it's not. The world doesn't believe in love your neighbor as yourself. The world does not believe as you wish men to do to you, do also to them. They do not believe that is a reasonable expectation. They believe that is unreasonable. They believe it is unreasonable, therefore they do it. It's unreasonable. It's not how things work in the world. It's never worked that way in the world. Might and power has always worked. At the national level, international level, it's also worked for mankind at the personal level. But that is exactly how God wants it to work. He says, if you do these things, you will have bruised egos. You will have bruised cheeks, euphemistically, and you'll be broke. You'll have bruised egos, bruised cheeks, and you'll be broke if you do the things that Jesus asked you to do. And the world says that's not reasonable. That's unreasonable. It's reasonable to God. It's a reasonable expectation to God. It is exactly, in fact, the motivation is what we started this chapter with in verse 27 in this section. He says, but I say to you who hear, love your enemies. This is the issue of when we express the love for other people, that's when we do these things. We love them when they persecute us. We bless them when they curse us. We do good to them when they don't do good to us. And that just kind of, doesn't that kind of grate, though, against your mind? God tells us that indeed he wants us to be Christ-like. Isn't this exactly what happened to Jesus Christ? Wasn't his cloak literally taken when he was crucified? His cloak, his garment was taken from him. His cheeks were literally beaten, weren't they? It's interesting he uses these verses in Luke chapter 6. How did Jesus Christ react when his cloak was taken, his clothes were taken, his robe was taken, and his cheeks were beaten? How did he react? He prayed and he forgave, didn't he? He prayed and he forgave. The practical application here is for those who have betrayed us, those that have lied about us, and those that have hated us, we're to pray for them. Now, I'd ask you if this has ever happened to you, if it's ever happened to you that indeed bad things have happened that you didn't think you deserved, I would suggest to you to do exactly this, is to pray for them. To pray for those people who have abused you or misused you or taken from you, because that's exactly what God wants us to. Now, this may come as a major, major shock to you, but the ministry is not always the most loved group of people. I know that is a shocking revelation to you. Sometimes people, I see people nodding already. See? I know that's a shock to you. We're not always the most loved. When you are praying for someone, it is very difficult to hate them. It's very difficult to think ill of them. It's very difficult to not want something good to happen for them or to them. And so indeed, we try and do exactly that, is to pray for those who may not exactly love us or like us. So So it's important. It is impossible to hate someone when you are praying for them. It is impossible to have any type of bad feelings towards someone when you have them in your prayers. And in fact, in the church, this must be a first provision, to pray and to forgive. We have all in the church who have been here 20 or 30 or 40 years seen many that have drifted away and possibly have said bad things about us, you individually or us collectively. I think these words talk to both the church generally and to us individually. We are to pray about them and for them and not to curse them and not to think ill of them. It's interesting that we need to ask God to remove any hatred and any animosity to all men, because it is conditional on our forgiveness, isn't it? He said, and we heard it sang, I tried to pick it out, I think it was sang today, my Spanish is muy mal, is that we are to be forgiven as we forgive. We will be forgiven as we forgive. God asks to perform acts that seem completely and unbelievably unreasonable, illogical, to produce certain expectations, which we'll discuss. He is not asking in these verses for you and me to change other people. He's asking us to change us. That's all he wants. He's not asking you to change your five best friends or the five closest people that you have at church. He's asking you not to change your coworkers. He's asking us to change us. Sounds good, huh? It sounds fairly simple. We no longer have to save the world or everybody around us. We're to look upon helping and working out our own salvation. Jesus goes even further if this wasn't enough. He tells us, in fact, whom we are to show this love to in verse 32. He says, but if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much back. So he's talking to us again. Again, isn't it reasonable that you would want to love the people who love you back? Of course. Doesn't it make reasonable sense? Isn't the reasonable, logical, common sense reaction that I give things to people? How do I know I want to, or why do I want to give people those gifts? Because they give me gifts. Why would I give a gift if I'm not going to give a gift? I found this out to be very, very true when I stopped keeping Christmas. Now, there are some wonderful people who observe that day. It's not what I'm getting in talking about. But I noticed the phrase, it is more blessed to give than to receive. When people would give me a Christmas present, I had a policy to graciously say thank you. Again, I had the option of saying, no, this is a pagan holiday based upon Saturnalia. If you'd look at any encyclopedia, you'd know how wrong you were. So this, therefore, is a pagan gift. Take it back. I won't be defiled. That would have been one reaction. I tried it. It didn't work. Didn't work well at all. And so I said, I'm going to decide to take the gift, right, and say thank you, right? Say thank you, right? So I did. You know what? I didn't give them anything, and I never got another present from them. That's funny, that, huh? We give things to people when we expect to get something back, don't we? We love people because it's easier to love them because they love us back. He says, don't even the hypocrites, the sinners, don't they do that? He says, what credit is it to you if you do that? But our reasonable expectation is to do that. Let's go back to chemistry. It's a reasonable expectation that if we conducted our chemistry reaction in reverse, it would be illogical. If I called the boss up and I said, boss, we're going to try something new today. I'm going to react these two volatile compounds in reverse order. What do you think? I'd probably be out of a job before the phone went dead. It's illogical. It's crazy. You'd never think that, to do it in reverse order. But indeed, this is exactly what Jesus asks us to do something completely contrary to many, many things that we know to do in life. It is an unreasonable expectation. So it is with God's law. In fact, we are following God's way, his law, when we love those who may not and cannot possibly love us back. They may be incapable of it. You know what? That's okay. He makes no conditions. He makes no qualifications here. None whatsoever. He does not say at all, love those people if there's a reasonable chance they will love you back. He says, give things to people where there is a reasonable chance of getting something in return. No. He says, going on in verse 35, he says, love your enemies, the people who don't love you. Do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. We call that, by the way, a gift. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. He asks us not to do the easy stuff. He asks us, in fact, to do the tough stuff, the hard things, the things we don't want to do. We want to be nice to people that are sometimes not nice. We want to respond in kind, don't we? I know I do. I know I will. I'll respond back. And that's not good. And that's a complete violation of these verses. It is the hard stuff. It is easy to be friends with those that are near and dear to us. But he almost, as if it were, tells us to seek out others that may not be our friends, that we still do dealings with. He says to love and to do good and to lend and to give, hoping for nothing in return. We do so to those we don't know in many cases. The people at work, the people in the market, surely the people on that miserable, no-good, lousy 210 freeway. We will never see those people again. That's probably one of the best instances in Southern California of doing good to strangers, because there's a lot of strange people in cars that I saw today. And they do some crazy things. And it's very difficult. And I do a lot of driving. And that's where I'm trying to start. I think Becky's noticing it, that the car is staying in one line for many, many miles without moving around, trying to jockey for position. It's the simple things in life that God tells us to deal with first, but they're sometimes very, very hard to do. The contrast is to do these things without a reasonable expectation of getting anything back from them, ever. You will love and forgive people without them loving you, or without their forgiveness, and do good to those who will never, ever do good to you, ever. You will give and never get anything back in return, and sometimes because they just can't. It's either not in them or they don't have it. And Jesus said here in these verses, it doesn't matter. But here is where the expectation is truly realized. Jesus said, you will be rich. You will be enormously, overwhelmingly, fabulously rich. Rich beyond all measures. Because it says, God will give you the reward. It says, do good, lend for hope and nothing, and your reward will be great. You will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the unthankful and the evil. Therefore, be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. It's an ellipsis. It almost means, as your Father in heaven is merciful to you, that you be merciful, that you be grateful because it has been extended to you. God will give the reward, and you will be in this great reward. You will be forgiven as you forgive. You will be given eternal life, and you will be God's child, one of his children. And that is a very great reward. So let me close with 3.5 short points. 3.5. Not 2, not 3, not 4. Three and a half. Number one, love and pray and forgive those who have ill towards you. That may be a very, very short list if you are blessed. It may not be such a short list in other instances. Have no ill toward any person. Love and pray and forgive those who have ill toward you. Number two, seek out ways to express this attitude with those around you. You may be the only influence of this type of attitude in their life, showing this unreasonable expectation, this seemingly illogical attitude that the world does not understand. Number three, be aware that we need to pray always to God to stay close to Him, to understand and be given great wisdom, because this does not come natural to man. It is only by God and His Spirit that we understand and how to apply these verses. That was number three. And the half verse is number four. The half one is, why don't we all start, as I will, in the fellowship hall. Better yet, we'll start right after services.